You know, at first glance, the Bible appears to be overly generalized with regard to salvation. It seems to be very cut and dry, very black and white, if you will. For example, you can read in Romans chapter 1, verse 17, that all who live by faith are justified. But that doesn't mean that all who are faithful are going to face the exact same circumstances. There exist a number of variables and things to take into account. So how can God lump everybody into this one category of being faithful? 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10 says that we're all going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ, give account for all that we have done, whether good or bad. Well, but since not everyone is tested the same way, how can everyone be deemed good or bad if they're not all given the exact same scenario? Some people run well, other people are hamstrung, but we're all supposed to run the same race. How does that work? Or Revelation chapter 20, verse 12, where we see this judgment scene and everyone is standing there before God and the books are open and their deeds are brought out. But what if one man's deeds are many and great because he's given many and great opportunities, and another man's deeds are few and small because, well, he's only given few and small opportunities? How does that work out, that everything is going to be fair and equalized? So what I'm getting at here is that the Bible alludes to the judgment of billions and billions of souls, but it doesn't seem to give much attention to billions and billions of individual challenges, individual hardships, individual special circumstances, if you will, or the lack of opportunities. So my question here, rhetorically, as we present the lesson here, my question is, does God factor in all those other things? Not everyone has equal intelligence. Does God factor that in when we stand before the tribunal? Not everyone has equal gifts or talents or abilities. Does God factor all that in? If he doesn't, how in the world can we compete? Then it would be only the best and the most able would be saved, and the rest of us don't have a chance. We're not all faced with equal circumstances. So does God factor in the difficulties and the disadvantages that we have to face? Or will he simply look at the overall final output? You know, like a pass-fail system here, just looks at the final grade and says, well, you made it or you didn't, not taking into account what we had to go through in order to get where we are. And then you can add into all this all these other variables, such as learning differences, different temperaments, different levels of education, different upbringings, different skin color, etc., etc. There's just a myriad of variables when you think about it. I proposed in this lesson that God most certainly knows what each one is facing and not facing, and he will judge fairly and mercifully. He will take into account all factors and all circumstances, and that he will not judge anyone beyond their ability to perform, because a merciful God would not do that. But on the other hand, at the same time, he's not handing out crutches to those who think that they deserve special treatment. There are no loopholes or escape clauses written into his gospel that only a few will find or a few can take advantage of. There are no trophies of victimhood there in the judgment day. God is not dumbing down the requirements of faith for anyone. And that doesn't mean that we all have the same measure of faith or the same level of faith. What that means is that every person who he justifies must have faith and must properly demonstrate that faith to the best of that person's ability. The rest of the lesson is commentary, but there it is right there, okay? I don't like getting personal in lessons, but I think sometimes it is advantageous to do so when you're trying to make the point that I'm making right here. I've been a Christian for a long time. I've seen a great diversity among Christians. I have seen Christians who are excellent at evangelism and cold contacts. I don't consider myself excellent in that area. I just am not gifted in that area. I think Buck honestly does a better job at that scenario than I do. There are some people I have witnessed who are excellent at hospitality and washing the feet of the saints. I do not excel in that area. That is just not my strength. I'm not saying I can't do it or won't do it. I'm just saying that some do it so much better than I do. There are others who are great singers. I heard a bunch of them here yesterday at Kirkland. And there are others who are great orators, great preachers. I don't consider myself great. I do okay, but I'm not great by any stretch. So my question then, as I look at things, is will these other people who are so much better, will they be justified before me? Will God smile upon these people, but when it comes to me, will he frown with disappointment because I couldn't measure up or wasn't able to measure up to the status of these other people? Now, I do have a gift, on the other hand, and I do believe that my gift is critical thinking and packaging of sermon ideas or spiritual ideas. Would that mean that God's going to smile at me but not at you if you don't have that gift? Does that mean he's going to look favorably upon me because I have these talents, he's given to me, but not at you if you don't have those? Will God judge all Christians by their Bible knowledge, by their Bible retention, by their Bible retention skills, by their memory skills, by their idea packaging? Can two men of very different circumstances and skill sets and talents and abilities both stand before God as equals? It's a big question. And whether you've wrestled with that directly or not, you probably have given it some thought. While the answer might seem obvious to some, this is something I have struggled with personally for a long time. And I'll give some of my own story here, very, very briefly. I was not brought up in a Christian home. My parents were divorced when I was young. My mom and my three siblings, we lived in virtual poverty for years. We moved around a lot. Most of the houses we moved out of were condemned right afterward, if that tells you something. I spent at least 18 months in a foster care system. When our family was separated, my brother, Tracy and I in one, my other brother and my sister in another. I had very few male role models in my life, very few. And the ones that I did have weren't always great role models. Everything I've come to learn as a preacher, I feel like I have learned the hard way. I've done it wrong first. Everything has been a series of trial and error. They talk about the school of hard knocks. I went through that, okay? So I understand that. I was on my own a lot through most of my preaching career, 25 years now. And most of that preaching career was without any tutoring. When I say most, I really mean all of it, because I didn't have anyone tutoring me. I was often isolated. I spent 9 years in Alaska, virtually separated from the rest of the brotherhood as far as preaching is concerned. I was ostracized by fellow preachers in Alaska and even here. I have gone through many trials and errors. I have faced many difficulties, a lot of which I cannot even make public. Is it fair that others who are raised in a Christian home and have good Christian parents and parents who have good marriages and excellent mentors, is it fair that they and I are all being held to the same standard? That's a tough question to answer. And it bothers me sometimes when I do hear some squeaky clean preacher who's been raised in a Christian home who brags about, I'm a fourth or fifth generation preacher. He marries into wealth. He has flawless children. He has beautiful, intelligent grandchildren. He's never faced any hardship, personal or otherwise. He's been ministering to a wonderful congregation. He's been well taken care of. He does more than me. He earns more than me. He's been given more than me. And then he has the gall, as I'm going to say it rhetorically, to talk about the difficulties of discipleship and the trials of faith and the fiery ordeals that preachers have to go through. Doesn't seem fair. How can we both be on the same page? How can we both be judged equally? Does God factor all of these things in for me? Or maybe for you, because many of you have similar struggles, or maybe even far worse than whatever I've described. And the question is, does God take these things into account? What about all your bruises and scars and trauma you may have faced when you were young, through no fault of your own? Does God take all that into account? Or maybe there's the fact that you have been denied a loving family or a loving and fulfilling marriage through no fault of your own. Does God factor that in? Does God factor in the fact that you may have been hurt and betrayed and taken advantage of by those who claim to love you and want to take care of you? Does God factor in the possibility that you grew up in a loveless home plagued with physical abuse or drug abuse or alcoholism? Does he take into account the fact that you may have been denied opportunity for education or financial prosperity while others seem to be able to go to college on a whim or money just falls into their lap? Does he factor in your lifelong battle that you might have with some problem that you were born with through no fault of your own, once again? Or maybe your ongoing debilitating struggle with health issues or old age or something like that. And if it's not your old age, then it's your parents' old age that you've been saddled with. Or maybe you've lost someone dear in your life. Maybe you've lost your spouse. And that hurts. Does God factor all this in? We could talk about ourselves, or we could turn the whole discussion on its head. For example, what about those who don't have all the benefits and privileges and comforts that you and I are enjoying right now? Does God still require them to be obedient? Does he require them to be faithful and to walk the narrow path? Will he factor in what they have been denied as he assesses and evaluates their faithfulness? Does their faithfulness look like your faithfulness? Buck and I have been going through preacher training here. Right now we're in the section on looking at the church after the apostolic age into the medieval age and then into the Reformation and into the Restoration. And what we're discovering here is that in the medieval era, Bibles were very rare and very expensive. All of them were written in Latin. Until the time of the printing press. In fact, the first book on the printing press was a Bible in Latin. And at that time, only 2% of the population of Europe could read. And the only gospel that a lot of people knew came through the friars and the priests and the denominational religions that you and I know about today. Whereas today, you and I can study Hebrew and Greek in its original language. We can have a number of Bibles. And if your Bible wears out, you just go to the bookstore or go to Amazon.com and you buy another one. It's really no big deal. You have resources, unbelievable wealth of resources to study your Bible with. Some people in foreign countries today, those countries are Muslim or communist controlled. The Christians must smuggle Bibles in. They have to worship in secret. They are under constant fear of being detected. What about us? We all drove here freely. I don't think we had to worry about, you know, being attacked or anything like that. We're all sitting here not worried about someone coming in here and arresting us all and taking our Bibles and confiscating our property, sending us to prison. But there are people in the countries that I mentioned here that do have to face that. What about those who die young, who are denied a longer life where they can make decisions and they can go through trial and error and they can have experiences of life? What about those who die very young? And I'm not talking just in childhood. I'm talking about like even in the 20s or the 30s. And the rest of us who are older than that, we're thinking, well, you know, I've gone through all the stages of growth and maturity and everything else, and I've been faced with all these things. Well, they didn't have that opportunity, so what about them? They didn't have a chance to do all those things. Will God factor that in? What about those who are raised in a family or a culture of false religion and have had to go through the grueling ordeal to overcome that and be re-educated by the Scripture, as opposed to us, who many of us, or possibly, for all I know, we grew up knowing that there was a God, that the Bible is the Word of God, that Jesus is the Son of God. We took that for granted, probably raised, some of us, in a Christian home, and we've been immersed in this since our youth. We've never been faced with having to make a huge, monumental change like these people have made. Will we all be on the same page? Once again, Romans 1:17. The righteous man shall live by faith. But you notice that God never said what a person is going to have to go through to have that faith. All he said was that faith must be present. If you read about the early Christians in the first century there, you find Christians who were arrested and beaten, their property confiscated. Some of them were in prison. Some of them were tortured. Many of them were killed. They had to live by faith, just like you have to live by faith, just like I have to live by faith. But clearly, they faced far more difficult experiences than you and I have faced. God did not see this as a problem. I know that might sound shocking at first. God did not look upon this as a problem. He measures faith based on two things at least, and that is our ability and then the legitimate expectations, meaning what you ought to do based on what you know and the opportunities he gives you and the strength that he provides. So God is not going to judge you based on your non-ability, nor on factors or situations that you couldn't possibly rise up to or overcome. We talked this morning about the parable of the talents there in Matthew 25. We have the five-talent man, the two-talent man, the one-talent man. Why are they not all given the same talents? Has everyone thought about that? They're not all given the same. And it even says in the text that they were given according to their ability, because not all people have the same ability. Therefore, the master did not expect from them all the same thing. And yet there was one expectation of all of them, regardless of their ability and regardless of their talents, and that was, do something with this talent that I'm giving you so that I don't get it back like I did from the one talent man. Put your talent to increase. Put it to good use. And so it is with all of us, as I see it, as I understand it. We are not all given the same talents. We're not all given the same skills. We are not all facing the same conditions. We don't all have the same measure of health, etc., etc., etc. Yet one thing is expected of us all, and that is be faithful in whatever you must face, regardless how it compares with someone else, even if it compares with everyone else. God takes all that into account. 1 Peter chapter 4, if you want to read that with me there in verse 12 and 13. 1 Peter 4, verse 12. Peter says, "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of his glory you may rejoice with exultation." Peter did not offer apologies. He did not offer explanations. He did not hand out crutches. He did not give a loophole or an escape clause. He did not sit there and say, "Oh, you poor things. Others don't have to face what you're about to face here. How unfair." He said, in essence, be faithful. You're about to go through some trials. Be faithful. Fiery ordeals. Be faithful. You're about to suffer, be faithful. Jesus says the same thing there in Revelation chapter 2, verse 9 and 10. He says a period of testing is going to come upon you, and some of you are going to be in prison, and some of you are going to face a grueling task here for your faith. And keep in mind that these are not people who are well off. He first of all says, you are already impoverished, and I know that, even though he does say that you're rich in your faith. So he doesn't sit there and apologize. Jesus doesn't sit there and go, "Oh, you poor things, I'm so sorry about this." Why would Jesus be sorry? The only reason you would apologize is if he did something wrong. So God is not doing something wrong by allowing us to go through what he knows that we are capable of facing. And so what does he say? Revelation 2, verse 10, we quote it all the time, "Be faithful until death." And he says, "And I will give you the crown of life." Just think about that. He doesn't sit there and say, "Well, it's going to go easier for you in the judgment because you had to go through this thing." He just simply says, "Be faithful." Jesus never says, "I'm going to lower the standard of moral responsibility for you," because, no, he says, just be faithful. And be faithful until you die. Not only are we to be faithful, but God is faithful. God is faithful as a merciful and understanding judge. I don't have time in this lesson, but in Romans chapter 3, verse 1 through 6, Paul makes the argument there that how can God judge the world if he, God, is not truthful and righteous and faithful to those who trust him? If he's not a righteous judge, then he has no business judging the world. And if he can't judge the world fairly and accurately, then he has no business being the judge. The fact that he can judge the world and will judge the world is fact in itself that he is capable of judging the world. Ideally, earthly judges do not just hear part of the testimony, part of the evidence, and part of one's circumstances, but all of it. They don't render a verdict apart from those things that I just described, but because of them. They don't say whether one's guilty or innocent, or determine that by what person can't do, their insurmountable circumstances, things beyond their control, but the facts of what did actually happen. Well, if we can expect that of earthly judges, then how much more should we expect that of a divine judge? A judge that knows all the facts. A judge that knows all knowledge. A judge that has all wisdom. And a judge that cannot be wrong. A judge that cannot be bribed. And a judge that will not show partiality and, yes, factors in all things. Think of the implications of that. And think also that we don't have to wait until the judgment itself to know that God cares about us, understands what we're going through, and is fully aware of what needs to be factored in. We're told in Hebrews chapter 4, we don't have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who's been tempted in all things as we are, and yet, if I could paraphrase, hasn't succumbed to the problem that we succumb to. Without sin, it says of him. Therefore, we can draw near with confidence to the throne of grace so that we may receive mercy and find grace in time of need. I would suggest to you, we are always in time of need. So we don't want to just come to the throne when, you know, we're facing some, what we think is big trial of life. Life itself is a big trial. And so we should always be coming through that to that throne. Not only do we have a fair and merciful judge, but we have a judge who's been through far more than myself and any one of you and any person on the face of this planet. Think of the implications of that. And I know what someone's going to say, because someone always says it, whether they say it out loud or they say it in their heart. Well, Jesus never had to face a broken home. And Jesus never had to face an alcoholic father. And Jesus never had to face drug addiction. And Jesus never had to face heart disease or cancer, or disfigurement, or a disabled child. And that's true. I'll concede the point on every case there. Furthermore, I'll say that while all that is true, he had to endure far more and far worse than all of that. Let me show you this. He didn't just have to face a broken home. He had to come and face an entire broken world. See, you and I are limiting our situation to the little tiny bubble that we have to live in and the tiny little circumstances comparatively to what we're dealing with in our own life. Jesus didn't do that. He came and took care of everybody's life. Came into a broken world and had to deal with all that. Not only that, but he didn't, if you're dealing with an alcoholic, which is a horrible thing to have to deal with in the family, Jesus came to have to deal with a whole world filled with alcoholism and all kinds of other isms and all kinds of addictions, all kinds of problems. Just think about that. Not just a disease did he have to face, but he had to face a world filled with disease. Not just a disability, but he had to face a dysfunctional world that was full of disabilities, full of darkness. I know it's easy for us to go crying on someone's shoulder or maybe crying on our own pillow sometimes about all the things we've had to face. I understand that. I've done that too. But that doesn't mean that we're right when we start comparing ourselves to Christ, who had to go through a whole lot more than we've gone through, and yet without sin. Not only that, but he knew what he was going to face. He knew what he was getting into. He consciously entered into these scenarios. And he didn't do it because he was just trying to test himself. He'd do it because he knew that no one else could do what needed to be done for you and for me. While we think about all those things, there's something else to consider, kind of the other side of this whole argument. While you and I may have our struggles and challenges, and they may be very real, I'm not trying to discount them, we need to be careful we don't start making excuses for ourselves as to why I can't be faithful, why I can't be obedient because of, you know, the scenarios that we pose to God, basically telling God why we are exempt. Now, all these points deserve a whole lot more time than I can give to them. And obviously, one of my bullets here got up there too soon. But if you have special circumstances there, let me get here. If you have some special circumstances that God factors in, that's one thing. But you can't create special circumstances and then assume that God is obligated to expect less of you because of your assigning something special circumstance. You know, people are doing that all over the world right now, especially in America. They're feeling entitled to being victims or entitled to some reparation or entitled to, you know, some kind of woe is me status because of decisions they make about themselves. God doesn't have to agree with that. If you have a special circumstance you're facing, that can be true in your own mind. God does not have to agree with that. Someone might say, and in fact I might say, oh, I just had an awful childhood, I had lousy parents, and that's why I can't be faithful, that's why I can't be responsible. As God takes all things into account, and he can do that because he's all wise and all knowledgeable and impartial, you have to understand that you and I are not in that same position. We can't take all things into account. Basically what I'm saying here in a nice polite way is you need to know your place. I need to know my place. And God certainly knows his place. God factors in circumstances beyond your control, not those that are under your control. And an awful childhood and the quality of your parents, well, that might be real, but that was beyond your control. But faithfulness and obedience, that is in your control, always has been, always will be, and is right now. Another point there is that negligence, poor judgment, failure to act on your part does not obligate divine mercy on God's part. God factors in circumstances, again, beyond your control, not the circumstances you created because of your own poor decisions. Peter alludes to that here in 1 Peter 2, verse 20, where he says, "What credit is there if when you sin and are harshly treated, you endure it with patience?" So if you're making, if I could just be blunt here, if you're making some really dumb decisions, some really unwise determinations. You're going down the wrong path because you're following really, you know, blind people. And I don't mean physically blind. I mean like morally blind, spiritually blind people. You're going down that path with them even though you've got the Bible telling you don't do that. And then you suffer because of that. Well, that's your own fault. You should expect that. I'm not saying that God isn't going to be merciful and forgive you or spare you all the consequences of those decisions. What I'm saying is you can't expect special treatment for crimes that you committed. If you're suffering because you're faithful to God, that's commendable. If you're suffering because of your own sins, your own laziness, your own procrastination, there's no credit there. So we're just trying to keep that balance there so we understand. And failure to learn or to read the gospel does not dismiss you from responsibility, because mercy and innocence is not achieved through ignorance, but only when you earnestly learn God's word and strive to fulfill that. We're told in the Old Testament, favorite quote out of the Old Testament, Hosea 4:6, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge." Deliberate knowledge is not a badge of honor, it's a badge of shame. Ignorance in the New Testament always is associated with darkness, disobedience, rebellion, the exact opposite of what God is looking for. What I'm saying here is that sometimes you hear someone say, well, I don't have all the knowledge of the Bible that others have, and thus I'm excused from moral responsibility. They may not say it in those words, but you kind of hear that coming out. And the reality is, many people simply will not take the time, make the effort, or choose to learn those things. This is not on the same level as a birth defect or being born into a disadvantaged family or circumstances beyond your control. These are decisions that a person is making on their own. And God says, if you're going to make that kind of poor decision, well, then you're going to suffer the consequence of that poor decision. So what is he saying? In essence, make much better decisions than that. Be faithful. Be obedient. Will God factor in all the variables, all the challenges, all the disadvantages, all the strikes against you when he reviews your life? Well, outside of this lesson, which is very brief in comparison to what it should have been, most certainly he will. Because of this, because this is what we expect from a fair and merciful, all-knowing judge. All that can work for you or against you, depending on what you do. He doesn't need you, does not need you and I, rather, to point out or to explain or remind him of all the things we're going through. He already knows that, and he will remember that. On the other hand, he's not going to let you excuse yourself and misinterpret the situation so, you know, so that you can see yourself in a better light, or so you can play the victim to avoid responsibility. He knows what you're capable of, and he knows what your potential is, and he will judge you accordingly. Just think about that. God's not going to give you too much. If you believe in God and trust in him, he will not overwhelm you. But what he does give to you may be more than you thought you could endure before he gave it to you. The lesson is not about you have no right to feel badly about what you're facing or what's happened to you or what's happening right now. What it's about really is you and I, myself included, we have no right to redefine or excuse ourselves from faithfulness and obedience because of what happened to us or what we're going through right now. I'm not suggesting for a minute that anyone's actually doing that, but our job as Christians must ever be, how little can I do? Or how much can I avoid? What it should be is, I will serve Christ to the best of my ability regardless of whatever I have had to deal with in my life. And that's where it all comes down to right there. I'm going to do my best. I realize I've got some disadvantages. I'm going to do my best. I didn't get the upbringing I wanted. I'm going to do my best. I didn't get what this guy had over here or this person over here. I'm going to do my best to be faithful. And not faithful on my own terms either, as I define it. I'm going to be faithful as what God defines it. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 9, it's really what Paul is saying. God is talking to Paul, and Paul is, remember, kind of complaining. I've got this thorn in the flesh, whatever that was. It really doesn't matter. It's obviously something plaguing him. And he entreated God through three rounds of entreaties, really, is what the three times means there. And God says, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. And so Paul went away miserable, his head hanging down, cried in his pillow for nights, and commiserated with all the other people who God has been very unfair with. Now, it doesn't say that, does it? Think about what Paul says. Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. And instead, then, of dwelling on our weaknesses, our disadvantages, our challenges, we ought to dwell on God's mercy, God's grace, God's forgiveness. We who are disadvantaged, if we are here tonight, we don't deserve grace any more than those who have been given everything. None of us deserve to be forgiven. God will take all your trials and hardships and injustices into account, but he does expect one thing from every one of us. To the best of your ability, be faithful, be obedient, because that is within your control. And believe me, the reward for that is more than you and I could even comprehend. God has great things in store for his people, but we have got to stay the course. We cannot allow ourselves to be sidetracked by ourselves or anyone else or anything else. That's our lesson tonight. If you need to respond by coming forward, this would be your opportunity. Come forward if you need to, and let us help you if we can as we stand and sing the song Bob selected for us here.